you.
Does that work?
It's great to be here in Montana. I think it's probably about the seventh or eighth time I've been in your state for speaking, skiing, and martial arts conferences and other things like that. But you have a beautiful state, and I can certainly see why they call this state Big Sky. Hoping to take advantage of some of your skiing in a few days and before I have to go back to Alabama. You probably figured out already I don't talk like an Alabaman, but I was down there with Air Force Reserve duty some years ago, and I learned about a law school there and had a chance to talk with the dean, and he said, we might be interested in hiring you as a professor here, but got a question. Do you think you could fit into the South? I said, no problem, sir. I was born in the South, and I thought I'd get by with that. But when he asked where, I had to say South Dakota. And that means I am the southerner in the family. My wife is from North Dakota, so she has a little more trouble adjusting. And they even let me teach my classes without an interpreter down there now. But anyway, it's great to be here in Montana, to be with you again, and hope to be spending some time going through the Constitution. As we look to the biblical background of our Constitution and the historical and theological foundations of it, the question that some people are going to ask is, well, what does theology have to do with history, and certainly what does it have to do with law and government and Constitution? After all, we have absolute separation of church and state, don't we? Well, here's the way I sometimes approach that question. I'll begin by asking, well, do we agree that God exists? And here in America, probably 85 to 90% of people will agree that God exists. They may not understand him quite like we do, but they'll at least agree that there is a God. Next question, well, if we agree that God exists, do we agree that he knows what is going on here on earth and here in our country? And again, if you were some parts of the world, they might say, well, no, he's just kind of an impersonal force, kind of like Star Wars. But here in America, coming out of the Judeo-Christian ethic, again, the overwhelming majority will say, well, yes, he knows everything. Yes, he knows what's going on here. Well, if God knows what is going on in our country, then the third question would be, does he care? Does it matter to him that, let's say, Jews are being liquidated in some part of the world, or that racism's taking place in another, or that babies are being aborted in another part of the world? Does that matter to him, or does he just not care about those things? Well, yes, I would think God cares, nearly everybody would say. He's, after all, a good God, and certainly he would think such things are wrong. Well, next question, if God cares about these things, would he communicate those cares to us? And most people think about it, well, I would think he would, yes. If I were God and I saw things going on that I liked or didn't like, I'd care about them, I'd communicate them. Well, how do you suppose he communicates those things to us? Never thought about that. Is it possible that he communicates through his word? Is it possible that the Bible contains principles that apply to law, to government, to constitutions? And once we open up that issue a little bit, people will start thinking, well, maybe the Bible does have something to say about law and government. And if it does, maybe we ought to pay attention to what it says. And that's what we're kind of trying to do here tonight and tomorrow morning. Look at the historical and theological roots of our Constitution. Libby began, and you're looking at the lecture outline that's titled The Biblical Roots of the Constitution. And let me begin by just talking about some basic principles of biblical law. And primarily, as we look to biblical law, we're going to be looking at the Old Testament, primarily to the Mosaic Law as we see it revealed in Genesis through Deuteronomy. And we'll also see that God has revealed his law to us in nature as well, what we call the law of nature or natural law. In fact, Martin Luther says that there is no better expression anywhere of what the natural law is than in the Ten Commandments. He said on one occasion, natural law is the Ten Commandments. It is written in the heart of every human being by creation. We can see we're in Psalm 19, for example, the heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament showeth his handiwork. And how it goes on to go from the special revelation to general revelation to special revelation. The law of the Lord is perfect and so on. And then we see in Romans, where in Romans 2:14, we are told that the Gentiles who do not have the law of Moses nevertheless have the law of God written on their hearts. Luther goes on to say it was clearly and comprehensively put on Mount Sinai, finer indeed than any philosopher has ever stated it. Natural law, then, is created and written in the heart. It does not come from men, but is a created law, to which every one who hears it cannot but consent. On another occasion, Luther wrote, the Decalogue is not of Moses. Now, don't misunderstand. He's not saying Moses did not bring the Decalogue down from Mount Sinai. He's saying, rather, it precedes that. In fact, as in this series that you have there in the table and back, Historical and Theological Foundations, we have one chapter titled The Justice in Genesis, where we show that all 10 of the Ten Commandments, which are given in Exodus, appear in rudimentary form in the book of Genesis as well. The Decalogue is not of Moses, nor did God give it to him first. On the contrary, the Decalogue belongs to the whole world. It was written and engraved in the minds of all human beings from the beginning of the world. So let's look right now at a few basic principles of law and government as we would see them in the scriptures. And you see that phrase under precepts of biblical law, ethical monotheism. There's a couple of big words, and what does that possibly have to do with law and government? Well, monotheism, of course, is the belief in one God. Now, you'll be told in nearly every university anthropology course today that man began polytheistic, worshiping many gods, and gradually polytheism evolved into monotheism. But prior to the 1850s, leading historians, leading Egyptologists, and other great professors of ancient history at Cambridge, at Harvard, at Oxford, at other institutions like this, were teaching the opposite. They were teaching that man began worshiping one God, and that monotheism gradually degenerated into polytheism. That's what the Bible says, that as man rebelled against God, we read in Romans that God gave him up to the worship of beasts and the created things and so on. In other words, man degenerated into polytheism according to the Bible, and that's what just about every great historian in world history has taught up until the 1850s. What happened in 1858 that would change all of that? Darwin, The Origin of Species. Nothing new discovered in anthropology or archaeology or ancient history or anything, simply a different worldview that came from Darwin's Origin of Species, that everything evolves, and that means man evolves, and therefore man evolved from polytheism into monotheism, when in fact it's the other way around. But what does monotheism versus polytheism have to do with the nature of law? Simply this, that if there is one God, there is one law. Just as if there is one God, there is one truth. Now, if we believe that there are many gods, then we're probably going to believe that Marduk of the Babylonians issued one law code, and that Zeus of the Greeks issued another, and Odin of the Norse issued another law code, and that various other gods of other systems issued their own law code. So you have all these conflicting law codes. But if there is one God, there is one law code. Secondly, we say not just monotheism, but ethical monotheism. Not only do we believe in one God, but we believe that he is a good God, that he is a God of morality. most of the other ancient legal systems and religious systems would not really equate their gods with moral beliefs particularly. Gods could be capricious and treacherous and duplicious and so on. But if you wanted to gain their favor, you'd pay attention to what commands they had given you, and you would follow those commands in order to incur their favor or avert their wrath. But in Christianity and Judaism, we teach that God is a good God, that God has ordained morals that are good morals, laws that are good laws. Now the question then arises, are they good laws because God commanded them, or did he command them because they are good? And the answer to that question is yes. In other words, you can't separate God from his character or from his ethical commands. But the point being, again, not only is there one God, but this one God has given a law code, and it is a good, moral, and right law code. Understanding, then, ethical monotheism leads us to this idea that there is such a thing as Jefferson said in the Declaration of Independence, the laws of nature and of nature's God, a higher law to which all human law must conform. Second principle of biblical law would be that man is created in God's image. Everything is created. Animals are created too. But only man is created in his image. Now that doesn't mean if you saw a picture of God that he looks like us. What it means rather is that we have a mind by which we can relate to God, a mind by which God can communicate with us, a mind by which God can communicate his moral standards to us, and that we have moral responsibility. God can hold us accountable for what we do. So man is created in God's image, and man is not only created in his image, but for that reason, he is not just part of creation. He is above creation. And you look to the rest of creation, we're not simply visitors as we go to a nature preserve. We're landlords, or at least we're building and ground superintendents. We're in charge. And one of the things that I find so ironical today is that in today's age that emphasizes Darwinism and New Age pantheism and the like, we hear and see so much about the need to preserve nature, the need for ecology. And I'm certainly in favor of sound conservation practices. But think about it a moment. If you're a Darwinist, why save endangered species? If there is a struggle for survival between humans and whales or spotted owls or whatever else it might be, and the spotted owls or the whales become extinct, according to Darwin's laws of survival of the fittest, that was exactly what was supposed to happen. But on the other hand, if you believe that God created man, gave him dominion over nature, and in giving him that dominion over nature, he also gave him a responsibility to take good care of his creatures, then we can see a basis for a sound conservation ethic. Not just simply a pantheistic ethic that we're part of nature, but rather that we are to use his resources wisely. In other words, being created in God's image has many implications. A third principle is that man has fallen into sin. Having fallen into sin, the consequences of that mean that we have willfully disobeyed God's law, the image of God within man has become marred, and that leads to the creation of civil government. Now, when was civil government first created? Well, some will say it was created in the days of Nimrod, right after the flood. There in the days of the world's first United Nations building, the Tower of Babel. I think it may have been created before that. We read of Cain right there in Genesis chapter 4 that he went out and that he founded a city. And a city and the type of population that you would have in a population increase of a couple thousand years between Adam and Noah, there would have to be some kind of government even at that time. But because of the fact of sin, God has established civil government for the purpose of restraining and punishing the exercise of sin. We need to understand that government can't take away the desire to sin, but it can make crime not profitable. If you're thinking about breaking into that window of that jewelry store and stealing that diamond bracelet in the window, you might be thinking, I'd sure like to have that, or the money I could get from selling it. But then you also think that if I did that, well, that policeman over in the corner would see me and he'd arrest me and I'd go to jail, and I guess it just isn't worth it. So civil government was created by God to restrain the exercise of sin. Now, in so doing, of course, government has to take precautions to ensure that the rights of innocent persons are not abused and that innocent people are not wrongly convicted. Almost alone among the ancient systems of the world, the biblical system has extensive protections for the rights of accused persons. In the mouth of two or three witnesses, let everything be established. You have to have corroboration of testimony. You have trial by jury in various forms, at least. You have another requirement that witnesses tell the truth, and you have a punishment for perjury. Here you commit perjury, you can get elected president for it. In biblical times, if you committed perjury, the punishment for perjury would be the same punishment that would have applied to the person in the trial if that person had been found guilty. In other words, perjury in a capital case was punished by the death penalty. So we have protections to ensure that no miscarriages of justice take place, or at least to minimize the possibility that they could take place. And anyway, once, of course, we have established the guilt of a criminal defendant, then punishments are in order. And so a purpose of government, then, is to restrain the exercise of sin and to do justice here on earth by punishing those who commit crimes. But remember, we talked about the fall of man. We talked about the depravity of human nature. One thing that I was speaking to a Lutheran pastor one time, and I told him I was going to be addressing an audience of Calvinists. And he said, well, I'll say this about Calvinists. Anybody who believes in total depravity can't be all bad. But one idea of total depravity and the universality of the sinful nature means that those who run the government have the same sinful nature as everybody else. And that being the case, one of the things that we try to do in establishing a government is, first of all, make sure that that government is going to have enough power to keep law and order, enough power to defend us from foreign invasion and also to defend us from the criminals on the streets, but also to make sure that those who run the government, that they too are restrained in their power so they don't become tyrannical and oppressive. I see you're having Father Serica of the Acton Institute, and that's a wonderful institute, but Lord Acton in England had made the statement that power tends to corrupt. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. I suspect most of us are familiar with that quotation. Anybody know the next sentence? The next sentence is that great men are almost always bad men. And that being the case, we have to carefully restrain their power. In just a little bit, we're going to talk about more of how the framers went about doing that. But the next thing we need to emphasize here as a biblical principle of government is that God has established two kingdoms, church and state. And these are intended to be two kingdoms, not the absolute wall of separation that we hear being talked about today. And I assure you that when these pilgrims and Puritans and the Jamestown settlers and others came to this country, some of them came to find religious liberty. They didn't come over here to get away from prayer at football games. They came here, those who came here for religious liberty, which was not all of them, but was many of them, because They didn't have that liberty in England. And when they saw abuses of religious liberty in England, what they saw was, for the first time in the history of the Western world, church and state united into one. Even in the medieval Roman Catholic Church, you don't see that kind of union of church and state. You see a lot of interference between church and state, sometimes in ways that were wrong, but you don't find kings becoming popes, and you don't find popes becoming kings. Officially, at least, the offices were separate. But then, in the 1500s, King Henry VIII wants to divorce Catherine of Aragon and marry Anne Boleyn. The Pope will not recognize an annulment for his marriage. And so, he separates England from the Roman Catholic Church, makes it the Church of England, with himself, the king, as the head of the church. That was the situation the colonists came to America from, a system in which you had an official state church with the king at the head. That's what they were trying to avoid. Now, that's also the situation in much of the ancient world outside of Christianity. In much of the ancient world, monarchs are absolute. They were thought to be divine. Emperor worship, state worship were the order of the day. In fact, one of the examples of that that you can see in the Old Testament is the example of King Ahab. Now, remember, Ahab had a wife whose name was what? Jezebel, possibly the wickedest woman in the entire Bible. This is before the days of Hillary Clinton. But Jezebel had been a Phoenician princess. And you may recall that the Phoenicians were many times allies of the Hebrew. They were ethnically very connected. Their languages were very, very similar. But their religious beliefs and their political systems were diametrically opposite. The Phoenicians practiced absolute government, state worship. Kings were thought of as divine. Now, Ahab was possibly a believer, but definitely an apostate, one who certainly was not a follower of the true God in any real sense of the word. But you recall he had his conflict with Naboth concerning the vineyard. And he wanted to buy Naboth's vineyard. Naboth said, nope, this vineyard belonged to my ancestors. I'm passing it on to my descendants, not for sale at any price. Now, as apostate as King Ahab was, he at least recognized that under Jewish law, they practiced limited government. And that if Naboth didn't want to sell his vineyard, he didn't have to sell his vineyard, and even if he was the king, he had no power to force Naboth to sell him that vineyard. Well, you recall, he goes back to the palace, and there he's having dinner, and his wife Jezebel sees he's not very happy, and she's asked what's troubling him. Well, Naboth won't sell me his vineyard. What kind of king are you that you're going to let some little peasant keep you from getting a vineyard? No Phoenician king would ever let that stand in his way. I'll get you your vineyard Phoenician style. And so she immediately goes out and has Naboth framed for false charges and executed and his property forfeited, and here is your vineyard, Your Highness. That's the absolute power that we see in most other nations. But in Israel, we see a separation of church and state. And I'm using church in the loose sense of the word here. But unlike these other nations, you find in Israel that the civil authority, the kings, come out of the tribe of Judah. The religious authority, the priests, come out of the tribe of Levi. Separate offices, separate functions, but both derive their authority from God, and both are subject to the law of God. I'm going to read a very interesting passage here out of 2 Chronicles chapter 19. It's concerning, I'm going to have to turn to that again, I'm sorry, but 2 Chronicles 19, where we're talking about King Jehoshaphat, and Jehoshaphat is leading a revival in Israel to try to restore things after a period of apostasy. And we read verse 5 of 19, and he set judges in the land throughout all the fenced cities of Judah, city by city, and said to the judges, take heed what ye do, for ye judge not for man, but for the Lord, who is with you in judgment. And I could read a lot more, but I'm going to pass on to the last verse of 19, verse 11. And behold, Amariah the chief priest is over you in all matters of the Lord, and Zebediah, son of Ishmael, ruler of the house of Judah, for all the king's matters. See the separation? You have the priest over the things of the Lord. You have this prince from Judah over the king's matters. Separation even at this time. And separation of church and state, properly understood, is a biblical concept. I don't want the government running the church, and I don't want the church running the government. But separation of church and state does not mean separation or divorce of government from God. God is the source of governmental authority. God is the source of human rights, therefore the source of limitations on governmental authority. Separation of church and state does not mean divorce of law from biblical values or any moral values. And separation of church and state does not mean separation of believers from the political process. Well, we're moving fast here. The time is moving faster than we are, I guess I should say. And so let's move on to second major point here, the worldview of the founding fathers. I was going to quote extensively from many of the founding fathers about their religious beliefs. I'm going to limit it to only a few instead. But when you look to the founding fathers, and you'll find people that will try to tell you today that these founding fathers were deists, that is, believers in a God who created all things but doesn't actively involve himself in human affairs anymore. He just lets things run according to his natural laws, and he's over in another galaxy, or maybe he went down to Argentina and is living in hiding down there or something like that, but he's not actively involved. That was a common belief in Germany and France at the time, but it was less common in England and much, much less common in the United States. In fact, when you look to these 55 delegates to the Constitutional Convention, we find that at least 51 of them were actively involved in Christian churches, and probably more, actually, but these are the ones we have firm records of. For example, we have 28 of them being Episcopalian, and that was a very Orthodox church in those days. 8 of them were Presbyterian. Those are your fiery Calvinists. You have 7 Congregationalists. That's mostly your New England Puritans. You have 2 Lutherans, 2 Dutch Reformed. You have 2 Methodists. You have 2 Roman Catholics. You have 1 McClurg of Virginia, who we don't know enough about. He's buried in an Episcopal churchyard, which indicates probable church method membership. But that leaves about 3 that we might describe as unorthodox, one of these being Ben Franklin. Franklin, not a deist, but it is Franklin who stands up at the convention and makes that statement at the convention that, I have lived, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. That's not a direct endorsement of Christianity, but it is about as direct a repudiation of deism as Franklin could possibly make. He goes on to say in that statement, and if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We have been assured, sir, in the sacred writings that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. I firmly believe this. And I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. That, coming from the man who, of all of those 55 delegates, was probably the least orthodox. We could look to Alexander Hamilton. I could say so much about Hamilton and his religious beliefs. Suffice it to say that when Hamilton was shot in a duel, and as he lay dying, he took communion shortly before he died, and he declared, I have a tender reliance on the mercy of the Almighty through the merits of the Lord Jesus Christ. Or we could go on to John Jay, who of all of the founding fathers may be my favorite. John Jay had been an ambassador to France and describes some of the anti-religious sentiment that he found in France, and talks about atheists there. He says, I was at a large party, of which were several of that description. They spoke freely and contemptuously of religion. I took no part in the conversation. In the course of it, one of them asked me if I believed in Christ. I answered that I did, and that I thanked God that I did. Nothing further passed between me and them, or any of them, on that subject. John Jay went on to be the first Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. Beyond that, Jay was also a founder and national president for many years of the American Bible Society. Here's one of his addresses, just a small portion of it, to the American Bible Society, when he says of the need to convey the Bible throughout the world, because there are so many, he says, that don't have the Bible. By conveying the Bible to people thus circumstanced, we certainly do them a most interesting act of kindness. We thereby enable them to learn that man was originally created and placed in a state of happiness, but becoming disobedient, was subjected to the degradation and evils which he and his posterity have since experienced. The Bible will also inform them that our gracious Creator has provided for us a Redeemer, in whom all the nations of the earth should be blessed, that this Redeemer has made atonement for the sins of the whole world, and thereby reconciling the divine justice with the divine mercy, has opened a way for our redemption and salvation, and that these inestimable gifts of God are the free gift and grace of Him, not of our deserving, nor in our power to deserve. So much more I could say about the Founding Fathers, but what about George Washington himself? Many will say that George Washington was not really very interested in church matters because he refused to take communion. Well, let's get a few of the facts about Washington in this regard. Before the War for Independence, Washington regularly took communion in his Anglican church. By the way, he was a vestryman in that church. To become a vestryman, he signed a sworn oath saying that he accepted the doctrine of the church, which included the authority of Scripture, the Trinity, the divine and human natures of Christ, justification by grace through faith, substitutionary atonement, and at that time, the 39 Articles of Calvinism. Now, if Washington didn't believe those things, if Washington was a deist, he perjured himself when he signed that oath. But second thing is, we know that during the War for Independence, he took communion at other churches, but would not take communion at the Anglican or Church of England. We know that after the war, he again took communion at the Anglican Church. Now, this is where we get the idea that Washington would not take communion. But think for a moment. Why do you suppose he wouldn't take communion in a Church of England during the War for Independence? Who's the head of the Church of England? King George III. Washington is leading a war for independence against King George III. Now, if he were not a man of principle and conscience, that might not have bothered him, but he felt he could not in good conscience take communion in the Church of England when he is at war with the man who supposedly is the head of that church. That's the reason. It certainly doesn't reflect any lack of belief in Christianity. When he resigned as general of the army to go back to making an honest living as a farmer, not knowing that there were other plans in store for him, he wrote a letter to the 13 governors announcing his resignation. In that letter, he referred to Jesus Christ as the divine author of our blessed religion. The historian Henry Cabot Lodge said of that statement, either Washington believed in the divinity of Christ, or when he wrote those words, he deliberately stated something he did not believe. And there is no evidence whatsoever that he did not believe that. Well, I could talk about so much more here, the sources of their ideas. I was going to talk about the election sermons that the colonial churches would commonly hold at election time, where the pastor would talk about issues of law and government, talk about how many thousands of hours of sermons people would listen to in those days, enough that would cover several bachelor's degrees at four-year universities today. I could talk also about where they quoted from, the sources of their quotations. The largest source of quotations in the Founding Fathers' writings by far comes from the Bible. About 33% of all quotations in their writings come from the Bible. Anybody care to give us a guess as to what book of the Bible they quoted most often? Proverbs would be in the right testament, at least. Deuteronomy, because Deuteronomy is the second statement of the law, and they're writing about law and government. Now, if you exclude the Bible and just look to the human authors they quote primarily Christian sources. Baron Montesquieu is a spirit of the law, is a devout Roman Catholic. Sir William Blackstone, of his commentaries, a devout Anglican. John Locke being third, not entirely orthodox in every respect, but I am convinced within the Christian camp. And some of the Greek and Roman authors, some of the French philosophes, they would quote them far less frequently, and when they did, they would quote them commonly negatively rather than positively. But now let's look to the dilemma that they face at that convention. The dilemma that they're facing is this. How do we create a government that has enough power to govern effectively, while at the same time restraining that government so it does not become tyrannical and oppressive? They'd seen the problem with a government that was too small with the Articles of Confederation. They'd seen the problem of a government that was too big and without enough restraint with the government of England. And we have to say that in comparison to most other countries of the world, England's government was moderate compared to most others. But how do we draw that balance? And their solution was to ensure that no one individual, no one office, no one agency, no one level of government got too much power. And so, as we show how they did that, we're going to look down to the bottom of the page here, and we're going to look at what I refer to as the Founding Fathers' Fivefold Formula for Freedom. My seminary professors would have given me an A for the alliteration, but whether they like the content, I'm not sure. But let's look at that fivefold formula. Number one, limited delegated powers. The idea that we are giving to the government only such powers as we the people have delegated to the government, and no others. Government has only those powers that we've delegated through the Constitution. Now, just to make sure that was clear, and they thought it was clear from the beginning, but just so that nobody down in the 20th or 21st century got that mixed up, they put it in concrete in the form of the 10th Amendment, where they stated that the powers not delegated by this Constitution to the United States, meaning to the federal government, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Now, the 10th Amendment is actually the cornerstone of freedom because this establishes the principle that government's power is limited. And if any government official says, "Show me where the Constitution says I can't do this," he's got it all turned around. He has to be able to show where the Constitution says he can do something, or he doesn't have that power. Let's understand the importance of this idea of limited and delegated powers. The Constitution begins with these words, "We the people." And some people, like Patrick Henry, for example, objected that it shouldn't say "we the people," it should say "we the states." Who really put the Constitutional Convention together? Was it the people or was it the states? Well, the Continental Congress is the one who called for the convention, but they called for the states to select delegates. And it goes on to say, "We the people of the United States." So both concepts are there. At the convention, each of the delegations from each of the states, each state had one vote to be cast as a majority of the delegates present and voting from that state chose to cast it. Once they had completed the ratification of the Constitution, the writing of the Constitution, they voted to approve it by states, and that's why you read in the end of the Constitution, done by unanimous consent of the states present. That's all 12 states, Rhode Island didn't send delegates, but not every individual from each of those 12 states was in favor, but a majority of delegates from each of the 12 states were. That's how you can say unanimous consent. And then, of course, it went to Congress and from Congress to the states to be ratified at state ratifying conventions. So the concept of we the people and we the states are both there in the Constitution. First, limited delegated powers. But who really gives power? Does all power rest with the people? Or does all power rest with God? I think the answer to that is found in the motto of the state of South Dakota, my home state. Anybody know South Dakota's state motto written by a Pastor Ward? Under God, the people rule. That puts it together beautifully. Second point, checks and balances. The idea that each of these, actually I should have had two and three turned around there. I don't know why I messed that up, but let's go to three first of all. Separation of powers, which should be two. God's word is infallible. My notes are not. The power that we delegate to government, we don't just simply give to one governmental agency. Rather, we separate it into three branches, legislative, executive, and judicial, the legislative powers being primarily in Article 1, executive primarily in Article 2, and judicial primarily in Article 3. And we have checks and balances among those branches. Congress passes law, the president can veto them, Congress can override the veto by a two-thirds vote of both houses of Congress, and arguably, although not clearly decided, the court has the power of judicial review to strike down an act that violates the Constitution. We'll talk more about that in the next hour here. But where does the court come from? Who sets up the court? Who comprises the court? Well, it's composed of people that are nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate. So you see checks and balances back and forth there. There was an important check that the states had in the federal government, and that's that some of us here would remember this. I don't think any of us are probably old enough to remember when this was actually the case. Have to be about 105 to remember that, but up until 1913, with the adoption of the 17th Amendment, up until that time, you did not elect your United States senators. You elected your congressmen, but your senators were chosen by your state legislators. And this gave the state legislatures an important check on Congress. Pretty hard for Congress to pass a law that's unpopular with the states if the states themselves are appointing the members of one house. Well, with the 17th Amendment, we now have popular election of senators. Supposedly, that's made things more democratic. In the process, I think we've lost a very important state check on federal power. So we've talked about the separation of powers. We've talked about the checks and balances. Then we have the concept of reserved individual rights. And when we speak about reserved individual rights, what we mean by this is that we are not a pure democracy in which we have untrammeled majority rule, in which the majority can ride roughshod over the rights of the minority. Rather, we have a constitutional republic in which the majority generally runs things, but in which the minority has certain rights that even the majority may not take away. For example, the right of free speech. If the city of Billings decided that they didn't want Big Sky Worldview to be conducting conferences like this because they bring in too many flaky and subversive speakers from out-of-the-way places like Alabama to talk about subversive concepts like constitutionalism, if they decided to shut us down, if the court is doing its job properly, it would strike that down as being a violation of free speech, even if 90% of the people of Montana wanted us shut down. The majority generally runs things, but the minority has certain rights that even the majority cannot take away. One of those rights, of course, is the right to keep and bear arms. And some would even question whether that's supposed to be in the Constitution or whether it really is an individual right. The Supreme Court has, I think, finally settled that with the Heller and McDonald decisions in the last several years, but only by a 5-4 margin. But consider this, that Justice Story described this right as the palladium of our liberties, that is, the outer wall of protection. The purpose of the right to keep and bear arms is not just for target practice or hunting or even self-defense. It is for a reserve militia to protect against not only foreign invasion, but also against domestic tyranny. And if that sounds radical, I suggest you address your complaint to James Madison and Alexander Hamilton, because they both raised that exact point in the Federalist Papers. And you could put it this way, that if I had a choice between the right of free speech or the right to keep and bear arms, I choose the right to keep and bear arms. And then I could say whatever I want because I have a gun. Well, somebody's put it another way, and that is that the right to keep and bear arms is an armed sheep protecting himself against a majority of wolves who have voted to have him for dinner. Finally, responsibility through religion. The framers did not want a state church, but they understood the role that religion plays besides the saving of souls in the building of solid character. George Washington, for example, in his farewell address, one of the most important addresses in American history, simply said, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports." And then he went on to say, "And let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion. Whatever may be conceded to the influence of refined education on minds of peculiar structure, reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principle." He understood that religion is the very pillar of civil society. It provides the kind of moral character that makes responsible self-government possible. We're going to talk about the war on the Constitution in the next hour, but now we have a special presentation, so I'll turn this over to Dick Vance.
Stay right there a second. I wanted this to do something different this time. But before I pray,